Okay, how are we doing?
Welcome. I'm Keith Pavelcheck from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'm director of the program to protect America's freedom. And I want to welcome you today. I never cease to be amazed at the turnouts we get for these sort of topics on a busy weekday. So I welcome you. I do have a brief introduction here that I hope you will indulge me. Almost a decade and a half ago, Stephen Carter, a Yale law professor and author who had gained some notoriety for a book entitled Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby, garnered a bit more attention for a book titled The Culture of Disbelief. Carter's thesis was summarized in the book's subtitle, How American Law and Politics Trivializes Religious Devotion. Carter's book was notable not so much because his thesis was original. It wasn't. The thesis had been argued and defended more rigorously by scores of scholars and public intellectuals before him. But it drew attention because Carter himself had certifiably liberal credentials. He was a professor at Yale Law School and was, an affirmative action baby. And he hit upon a helpful example to explain his thesis. Carter explored the debilitating political and cultural effects of treating religious belief, or theologically informed convictions and behaviors, as if they were a hobby, along the lines of, say, building model airplanes. Of course, the belief that theologically informed conviction is just like building model airplanes is itself little more than a superstitious indulgence of those who wish it were so, a view most profoundly evident among our political, media, and academic elites. Back then, people like Carter were trying to explain the importance of strange and exotic beliefs of American Christians to his uncomprehending Ivy League colleagues. Well, fast forward 15 years, and we now find ourselves in a world trying to make sense of the theological and political differences not merely between American evangelicals, fundamentalists, mainline Protestants, and Pentecostals, but between Sunni and Shia Muslims. And we're now forced to grasp with things like the geopolitical and security implications of the theological eschatology of the president of Iran, the meaning and interpretation of fatwas and open letters from Muslim leaders, the reconsideration of blasphemy laws, civil sanctions for apostasy, the implications of imposing Sharia law not only in the Arab world, but in Europe as well, with commentaries by the head of the Anglican Communion, as well as the fervent and audacious hope of many that something called an Islamic caliphate might be reestablished. We now have to take stock of those whose religious convictions have very little in common with benign hobbies like building model airplanes, but have very much in common with hijacking real ones and driving them into real buildings with real people. All of which just might suggest that we can no longer afford to indulge the superstition that religion is just some sort of privatized hobby, or that religious or theological grounded political convictions and behavior can be explained away by being reduced to some other factor, whether ethnic division, class stratification, lack of economic opportunity, and the like. And that we might do well to be deeply suspicious of those who have indulged such superstitions and who continue to do so. But more importantly, we would do well to pay attention to those scholars and public intellectuals who never indulged such superstitions in the first place. George Weigel and Philip Jenkins, for instance. When I told a friend a few months ago that we had invited Weigel and Jenkins to discuss the implications of the rise of Islam in Europe, he asked a bit sarcastically, "What will you call it? Islam in Europe? Catastrophe or mere disaster?" I'm not sure that entirely captures the nuances of their respective views, but we'll see. George Weigel is a distinguished senior fellow here at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a Catholic theologian, and one of America's foremost commentators on issues of religion and public life. He's the author of 15 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Witness to Hope, the biography of Pope John Paul II, The Cube and the Cathedral, and most recently, Faith, Reason, and the War Against Jihadism, A Call to Action. If you haven't got it, get it. But I don't know if you can get it out here. Philip Jenkins is Distinguished Professor of History and Religious Studies at Penn State University. He's the author of the widely acclaimed Future of Christianity series, The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity, The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South, and most recently, another book you should get hold of is God's Continent, Christianity, Islam, and Europe's Religious Crisis, which has everything to do with our discussion today. Please welcome Professor Jenkins, and they're each going to speak for 15, 20 minutes. Then we're going to give them the time to chat among themselves, and we're going to leave plenty of time for questions and answers following that. Please, Professor Jenkins.
It's obviously a great honor to be at this center today. As I looked around the room as I was coming in, and I see the certificates for the various winners of the Shelby Cullum Davis Award, and the first one I noticed was the award to William F. Buckley. So truly we are surrounded today by a cloud of witnesses. I thought of avoiding the cliche, but I cannot. A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of Islam and Islamization. We've all heard stories of creeping Islamization in Europe and some of the particular claims, particular words which have been used here, particularly the idea of Eurabia, that Europe would slide into becoming basically an offshoot of the Arab world, of the Islamic world. We have the famous remark by Bernard Lewis that by the end of the century, Europe will certainly become part of the Western Maghreb. France will be, in other words, part of, if you like, an Algerian or Moroccan world. And you may also see some of the parody maps that sometimes circulate of Europe in the near future, with Britain listed as North Pakistan and so on. And these ideas have, of course, been very powerful, and they've shaped policy making. I found myself in an interesting position here. Over the years, my political stances on things have certainly been, you know, reasonably hard line on these things, and I'm certainly happy to share George's views on the necessity to confront jihadism. I also think there are very important qualifications that we need to make in understanding this, and I think we have let some myths carry us away. And many of them concern the idea of numbers and demographics. So bear with me a little bit on this. The idea that old stock European Christians will be outbred, will be swamped, has become quite common. I quote a story in the book, which is a friend of a friend story. This didn't happen to me, but it happened to a friend of a friend, which was a Catholic in Duisburg in Germany, being told by a group of Turks, "Wir gebären euch kaputt, we will outbreed you." And there are many stories like that. A couple of points about numbers, because they are critical. You take very very serious, very you know, sober scholars like Fouad Ajami, and they look at Europe's birth rate and the birth rate of neighboring societies, the one being much lower than the other, and they end with the important line, "That is Europe's neighborhood and its destiny." Well, demography and destiny. key figure that we need to bear in mind. In order for a population to remain stable, you need a total fertility rate of about 2.1 children per woman. That's a critical figure. If it falls significantly below that, then you get population decline. You get an older population. In the context of Europe, that means you have fewer and fewer people able to work, able to support a generous welfare system. And many European countries have fallen significantly below this figure. They've fallen to 1.2, 1.3, which is an unsustainable figure. And that's given rise to the idea that Europeans will be swamped as more and more people come in from other countries, and particularly Islamic countries. In some parts of Europe, the fall in fertility is astonishing. It reaches figures that have, I suppose, rarely been matched in history. Parts of Germany have managed to hit 0.8, which is a demographer's nightmare. So let's start with the idea of numbers. How many Muslims are there in Europe? You know, that's a very tough question. If you look at what you might call the official figures, which I'll talk about in a moment, then the present number of Muslims in Europe is round about 4.3%, if you look at the countries of Western Europe. If you broaden it out to the whole of Europe west of the Russian border, then you also get about 4.5%. And the first thing I'd say is let's put that in context a little bit. You know, we've heard so much talk recently about elections in the U.S. and, you know, how will Latinos vote, how will African Americans vote. And if you think about a particular state or region in the U.S. and you were told the minority population there is about 4.5%, then your comment would be, oh, it's an all-white area. In other words, we tend to think of minorities on a very different scale. The first thing is then that the numbers are actually relatively low. Secondly, all those figures are absolute maximum estimates. And one thing that has happened in writing about Islam in Europe is that there has been an inflation of numbers, partly because of a general panic, a general fear about this. And some of the things that have happened have been quite interesting. Somebody a few years ago mentioned that the number of Muslims in Europe was 5%. By the time that got quoted, it suddenly became 5 million, which is an unsustainable number. You cannot defend that number. And the short answer is we don't have a very good idea, but all the figures you see are maximum figures. To suggest what some of the problems are here, I'd like to like you to imagine a visit by two friends. On my one side here, I have my friend Tony, who is of Catholic background, and my friend Tariq, who is of Moroccan background. Both of them are actually very similar individuals. Both drink too much. They engage in drugs. They are sexually enthusiastic. Neither of them is what you would call a religious person. Tariq here believes his father goes to a mosque but has no idea where it is, and basically has no interest at all in Islam. The reason I introduce my friends here is that in all statistics on the number of minorities in Europe, Tariq will always count as a Muslim. Tony here will never count as a Christian. We're using different standards for identifying religious populations. And when we talk of Muslim, what we basically mean is someone whose family roots lie in a country in which the default religion is Islam. We have to be careful about that. It's not that long ago that when Europeans looked at the situation they were facing in terms of minorities, they did not speak of Islam. They spoke of race. And many would say that race is at least as good a prism for exploring European social conflicts as is religion. In Great Britain, for example, the opposite of Muslim is white. France, with its however many million or so Muslims it has, up until a few years ago, a large part of that population regarded itself primarily as black. It regarded itself in racial terms. The classic distinction from the 70s onwards in France of different populations was black, blanc, and beurre. Black, white, and Arab. Not a religious designation. I encourage you in England, for example, to look at some of the reports on the very serious race, the very serious riots which struck northern cities in the summer of 2001, all of which are described as race riots in which religion does not play a significant force. A couple of years later in France, we have an intifada in the fall of 2005. What happens between the one and the other? Well, of course, 9/11 happens, and Europe discovers its problems in religious terms. It discovers the language, the concept of Eurabia, and is determined to apply this. Another point about numbers. Europe clearly is not friendly soil, to say the very least, for traditional organized religion. Some of us would see it as a malarial swamp for traditional organized religion. And that kind of attitude has certainly affected social attitudes, demographic attitudes. However, people who believe that Europe is being Islamized very radically, very rapidly, also tend to suggest, I'm not certainly not speaking of Georgia, that the Muslim populations that arrive in Europe will be immune from these same trends. And there is strong evidence that Muslim populations, broadly defined, including my friend Tariq, are experiencing demographic trends very much like those of old stock Europeans. In their home countries, their birth rates might be very high. They might be 6 or 5 children per woman. By the time they have been in Europe for a generation or so, they are moving rapidly towards European rates. I would suggest that one of the most important trends around the world today, and certainly in the Middle East, is the collapse of fertility rates in the Muslim world. The Muslim world is becoming very much a two-tier world, much of which looks distinctly European. And the countries that are most rapidly affected by this are the countries with close ties with Europe, Algeria, Tunisia, and increasingly Morocco. Algeria is a fascinating example. If ever you look at the statistics for the birth rate of any Muslim country, be sure that you're using a 2007 data source, because that would be lower than 2006, which is lower than 2005. Algeria, Tunisia are already way below fertility. The other interesting example there, by the way, and the sharpest decline, is Iran, which is rapidly heading towards Danish fertility rates. I imagine a time in 10 years when the government will say, let us launch a jihad, and a bunch of 40-year-olds will say, nah. I sometimes say that the group with the richest future in the Middle East is not Hezbollah, it's the AARP. There is a definite demographic shift. There's a well-known point in European demography, which is the closer a woman lives to Rome, the fewer children she has. That also works across the Mediterranean. So Europe, for whatever reason, spreads its, what shall I call them, its blessings, its demographic blight, whatever you want to call it. And when the number of children declines sharply, so do many of the pressures bringing families towards organized religion. You have a more individualistic society, intolerant of tradition, and so on. There's a major change in progress. It's critical to understanding the Islamic world and to Islam in Europe. When we look at Islamic populations in Europe, and I'm increasingly uncomfortable using that term, we see radical changes among women, especially in Europe. And we see a transition from traditional honor-shame societies where women are part of the family unit to a new kind of individualism. Don't forget, many of the complaints that people cite about Muslim populations in Europe not long since were also true of many Christian European populations. One example I always like is Italy abolished the defense for honor killing. Yes, we killed her, but she'd violated the family honor as recently as 1981. And that was not intended as a concession to Muslims. My concern is, however, I see a society in Europe, of Muslims in Europe, that is shifting quite swiftly to share European standards. I also see factors that could prevent or limit or delay this. And primary among these is what I call the self-fulfilling prophecy. Particularly since 2001, European governments have decided they have a Muslim problem. And if you have a Muslim problem, that means you must speak to Muslims. If you speak to Muslims, you do so by identifying certain entities as their representatives through whom we shall communicate. And the danger of that for me is that by speaking to people as Muslims rather than as citizens, as British people or French people, you are making them more Muslim. And over the last few years, for example, European governments have consistently identified some of the most hardline, rigid, intolerant groups as the authentic representatives of the Muslim population, as if they, of course, the local imam should be the person who makes decisions for your community, however much that conflicts with other ideas you have. That's a very powerful means of delaying or preventing assimilation. You know, I sometimes use the analogy, just imagine in the 1920s of confronting its Catholic immigrants from so many different countries. The U.S. government had said that it would only communicate with these people through their monsignors and bishops. In other words, it would not see Americans, it would see Catholics. And that would have delayed assimilation significantly, especially when so many of the European Muslim groups represent foreign governments. I'd also emphasize the idea of time frame. How long has Western Europe had its substantial Muslim populations? Basically about 40 years. How is the United States doing with the assimilation process 40 years after the great onset of its mass immigration of the 1890s? What did assimilation look like in the 1920s and 1930s? And the answer is quite bad. In other words, it takes several generations to move from, if you like, point A to point B to achieve assimilation here. I'll just make one final point because I think I'm at about the end of my assigned time here. Last year I was at a conference on Islam in Europe, and I found myself with a rather surprising reaction. I was in London, and I was listening to various people who represented these forms of liberal Islam. And they were advocating quite sweeping, you know, liberal and feminist changes within the faith, even at one point to the point of suggesting that anything within an organized religion that could not be reconciled with the UN Declaration of Human Rights needed to be changed by law if necessary. And I thought, oh, but that has some implications for some Christian churches. And I was rather interested. I actually found myself having much more sympathy for a conservative Muslim leader, violently anti-extremism, if you can be violently anti-extremism, in favor of democracy, somebody who's spoken out very strongly against anti-Semitism, for example, I'm thinking of the Grand Mufti of Egypt, And it occurs to me that the opposite of radical violent extremism is not secularism. It is, I suppose, mainstream forms of Islam and of Christianity and of Judaism and other religions. So, you know, do I see the coming of Islam to Europe as a catastrophe or a disaster? Well, the answer is neither necessarily. But if European governments carry on as they seem to be, they could yet achieve that. So, I suppose my basic point is I am not here as Pollyanna, but I believe there is a dose of realism that I think needs to be injected into many of the stories of Eurabia. Thank you very much.
There we are. Good afternoon, one and all. Thank you to Keith and his program for inviting me to share some thoughts with you. Hello, Rick. I didn't see you there, and good to see you, too. I want to thank Philip for typically provocative analysis. Philip Jenkins has been, for the last 20-some years, one of the great intellectual provocateurs in the best sense of the word in American public intellectual life, and I'm glad to see he's not losing his edge as he continues on in Happy Valley there with Joe Paterno. You mentioned Stephen Carter at the beginning, but Philip and I have killed an inordinate number of trees by publishing far too much over the last couple of decades, but we have not figured out what Stephen Carter figured out, which is if you really want to make some money out of this, write novels, not the kind of stuff that we write. It seems to me that the question of Islam and the fate of Europe is unlikely to come into clear focus absent some reflection on the current crisis of European culture, much of which shows up in some of the political attitudes that Philip described. The current crisis of European culture, or what I've now called for 5 years the European crisis of civilizational morale. I want to illustrate some of the terms of this, not by my own thoughts on the subject, but via the work of two distinguished European intellectuals. One is a philosopher of science in the school of Karl Popper and a non-believer. The other is a Catholic theologian. One is the immediate past president of the Italian Senate, in which he continued to serve until the recent dissolution of the Italian government. The other is the Bishop of Rome. The first, of course, is Marcello Pera. And here is what Professor Pera, Senator Pera, had to say in an important lecture at the Pontifical Lateran University in Rome, which was subsequently published in the book he co-authored with Joseph Ratzinger, Without Roots, the West, Relativism, Christianity, and Islam. Here's what Professor Pera had to say there. Optimism is obligatory, but it's cheap. In the current situation, there is a heavy price to pay. Relativism has wreaked havoc, and it continues to act as a mirror and an echo chamber for the dark mood that has fallen over the West. It has paralyzed the West when it is already disoriented and at a standstill, rendered it defenseless when it is already acquiescent, and confused it when it is already reluctant to rise to the challenge. One should not think of philosophy as a luxury for initiates to be consumed only within the walls of the university. Philosophy is rather a powerful tool for the promotion and spread of ideas and energy, and a vehicle of influential opinions. It always has been. It would thus be mistaken to think that relativism has never hurt anyone, or that it has never steered anyone down the wrong path, or that it represents the height of theoretical tolerance, political elegance, and philosophical refinement. The opposite, instead, is true. The relativism that preaches the equivalence of values or cultures is grounded not so much in tolerance as in acquiescence, more inclined toward capitulation than awareness, more focused on decline than on the force of conviction, progress, and mission, which were once typical of Christianity, Europe, and the rest. This raises the question of the Christian roots of Europe. When the proposal was made to insert a reference to the Christian roots of Europe in the preamble to the European Constitutional Treaty, it was rejected for reasons that should give us food for thought. John Paul II's personal commitment to this cause was well known. In 2004, he delivered a series of statements on the subject. The identity of Europe would be incomprehensible without Christianity, he said. You don't cut off the roots from which you were born. He also said, may Europe be itself and come to terms with its Christian roots. The essence of his argument could be summed up in a single quotation. The Christian faith has shaped the culture of the continent and is inextricably bound up with its history to the extent that Europe's history would be incomprehensible without reference to the events which marked the first great period of evangelization and then the long centuries in which Christianity, despite the painful division between East and West, came to be the religion of the European people. Unfortunately, those words went unheeded, like a vox clamantis in deserto, a voice crying in the wilderness. The proposal was rejected, and the defeat was round. What is most disturbing is that it was accompanied not by a bang, but by a whimper. Not even the church, in my opinion, rose to the challenge. The reason for this half-heartedness is not because there is some truth to the proposition that Europe does not have Christian roots, or to be more precise, Judeo-Christian roots, or because our freedoms and our liberalism do not depend on the Christianity from which they are derived and to which they are bound. On the contrary, it is true that almost all the achievements that we consider most laudable derived from Christianity or were influenced by Christianity, by the true message of God become man. In truth, without this message, which has transformed all human beings into persons in the image of God, individuals would have no dignity. In truth, our values, rights, and duties of equality, tolerance, respect, solidarity, and compassion are born from God's sacrifice. In truth, our attitude toward others, toward all others, whatever their condition, class, appearance, or culture, is shaped by the Christian Revolution. In truth, even our institutions are inspired by Christianity, including the secular institutions of government that render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and the list goes on. So why then did this proposal fail, and why were its proponents so feeble? Why was the Pope's insistent appeal ignored? My own explanation is that in the age of triumphant relativism and silent apostasy, belief in the true no longer exists. The mission of the true is considered fundamentalism, and the very affirmation of the true creates or raises fear. Thus, Marcello Pera. Imagine a head of the American Senate speaking in such terms. And the second European intellectual who has analyzed Europe's crisis of civilizational morale with great acuity is Joseph Ratzinger, who prior to his election as Pope had this to say in a lecture to the Italian Senate, imagine a cardinal addressing the U.S. Senate, which he'd been invited to deliver by Marcello Pera. Ratzinger said, "There is a paradoxical synchrony in the current world developments. The victory of the post-European techno-secular world and the universalization of its lifestyle and thinking have spread the impression, especially in the non-European countries of Asia and Africa, that Europe's value system, culture, and faith, the very foundations of its identity, have reached the end of the road and have indeed already departed from the scene. From this perspective, the time has come to affirm the value systems of other worlds, such as pre-Columbian America, Islam, or Asian mysticism. At the hour of its greatest success, Europe seems hollow, as if it were internally paralyzed by a failure of its circulatory system that is endangering its life, subjecting it to transplants that erase its identity. At the same time as its sustaining spiritual forces have collapsed, a growing decline in its ethnicity is also taking place. Europe is infected by a strange lack of desire for the future. Children, our future, are perceived as a threat to the present, as if they were taking something away from our lives. Children are seen as a liability rather than as a source of hope. There is a clear comparison between today's situation and the decline of the Roman Empire. In its final days, Rome still functioned as a great historical framework, but in practice, it was already subsisting on models that were destined to fail. Its vital energy had been depleted. A crucial element of the European identity is religion. I do not wish to enter into the complex discussion of recent years, but to highlight one issue that is fundamental to all cultures: respect for that which another group holds sacred, especially respect for the sacred in the highest sense, for God, which one can reasonably expect to find even among those who are not willing to believe in God. When this respect is violated in a society, something essential is lost. In our contemporary society, thank goodness, anyone who dishonors the faith of Israel, its image of God, or its great figures must pay a fine. The same holds true for anyone who dishonors the Quran and the convictions of Islam. But when it comes to Jesus Christ and that which is sacred to Christians instead, freedom of speech becomes the supreme good. The argument has been made that restricting freedom of speech would jeopardize or even abolish tolerance and freedom overall. There is one major restriction on freedom of speech, however. It cannot destroy the honor and the dignity of another person. Lying or denying human rights is not freedom. This case illustrates a particular Western self-hatred that is nothing short of pathological. It is commendable that the West is trying to be more open, to be more understanding of the values of outsiders, but it has lost all capacity for self-love. All that it sees in its own history is the despicable and the destructive. It is no longer able to perceive what is great and pure. What Europe needs is a new self-acceptance, a self-acceptance that is critical and humble if it truly wishes to survive. Multiculturalism, which is so constantly and passionately promoted, can sometimes amount to an abandonment and a denial, a flight from one's own heritage. However, multiculturalism cannot survive without common foundations, without the sense of direction offered by our own values. It definitely cannot survive without respect for the sacred. Multiculturalism teaches us to approach the sacred things of others with respect, but we can only do this if we ourselves are not estranged from the sacred, from God. Unless we embrace our heritage of the sacred, we will not only deny the identity of Europe, we will also fail in providing a service to others to which they are entitled. To the other cultures of the world, there is something deeply alien about the absolute secularism that is developing in the West. They are convinced that a world without God has no future. Multiculturalism itself thus demands that we return once again to ourselves. We do not know how things will go in Europe in the future. The Charter of Fundamental Rights may be a first step, a sign that Europe is once again consciously seeking its soul. Here, I must agree with Toynbee that the fate of a society always depends on its creative minorities. Christian believers should look upon themselves as just such creative minority and help Europe to reclaim what is best in its heritage and to thereby place itself at the service of all humankind. Ratzinger in 2004. Now, it is certainly true that these rather stark descriptions of Europe's current cultural situation are not all there is. There are all those creative minorities at work, from the western borders of Russia to the western coast of Ireland, and I expect many of us have encountered them and take hope from them. But it's clear to Pera and Ratzinger, and it should be clear to us, that these creative minorities are swimming against the cultural tide, or at least the high cultural tide, which tends toward the kind of multiculturalist appeasement that Pera and Ratzinger describe, and precisely for the reasons Pera and Ratzinger describe, among which the keys are metaphysical nihilism, or what David Hart suggestively calls metaphysical boredom, with the mystery of being itself, along with the epistemological skepticism and moral relativism that are nihilism's offspring. This is not, to put it gently, the optimal situation in which to assimilate large numbers of immigrants from a different and often hostile cultural civilizational orbit. The evidence for that is all around us. France tried de facto segregation of those immigrant communities in its suburbs. Now, at least prior to the election of Nicolas Sarkozy, that segregation has led to enclaves of Sharia law where the writ of French law does not run. There are similar patterns of Sharia enclaves in the United Kingdom and in the Low Countries. As the pseudonymous columnist Spengler, aptly named Spengler, recently wrote with reference to Dr. Rowan Williams' suggestions on the accommodation of certain aspects of Sharia law within the British legal system, Williams' exercise in what might be called the higher hypocrisy shows how deeply Europe has descended into the Dar al-Harb, or the House of War, in the Muslim terms for all that lies outside the House of Submission, or the Dar al-Islam. Europe's governments refuse to rule, that is, refuse to enforce their own laws because they fear violence on the part of Muslim immigrant communities who refuse to accept these laws. No-go zones proliferate that non-Muslims may not enter. In the United Kingdom, according to evidence presented by respected journalists and public interest organizations, Muslim community organizations, Muslim police officers, and medical personnel collaborate to stop women from escaping domestic violence. This kind of appeasement leads, I think, to the denial of certain core Western political values, including the equality of women legally and politically, free speech, and free press. In other words, it leads to what Bataillard and Bernard Lewis have called self-dimitude, in which native European populations become dhimmis, second-class citizens, not by conquest, but by preemptive acquiescence to what are assumed to be the non-negotiable demands of immigrant communities. This appeasement mentality has also led to an Orwellian perversion of language, such as that recently ordered by, I believe it was the BBC, which said that its correspondents were no longer to refer to Islamist terrorism, but anti-Islamist terrorism. It also leads, this appeasement mentality, to the acceptance of the kind of manufactured rage we saw in the Danish cartoons controversy as normal political behavior. On the larger scale, this appeasement mentality has also had a profound impact on European and NATO foreign policy, such that many of the European NATO forces in Afghanistan today now operate under rules of engagement that effectively take them out of combat operations. Why? In order to appease misinformed public opinion at home via low casualty rates. I've concentrated here on ideas and their impact on cultural morale and public policy, but I'd like to also take up briefly the demographic issue, which Philip explored so interestingly a moment ago. Let me add to his numbers some interesting numbers that might further complexify the picture. When 40% of the teenagers in Rotterdam and Amsterdam are Muslim and live in a country that is so detached from its own roots that Dutchmen rename Lent as Christian Ramadan in order to sell the idea of penance for 40 days, we have some idea that the public future of the Netherlands is going to be a bit different 20 years from now than it is today. Or at least that would seem to be one plausible possibility. When Muhammad and its variants is the second most given boy's name in England and Wales, in a country in which the head of the state church proposes a parallel legal system to accommodate Sharia, we have some idea of what the politics south of Hadrian's Wall are going to be like in, say, 2030. Or at least we have some inkling that they will be rather different than they are today. When close to 30% of young Germans, male and female, say they have no intention of having children and see nothing wrong with that, we're at a point where fiscal catastrophe, security catastrophe, and moral catastrophe all intersect. In other words, to put it in the largest frame, when virtually an entire continent, healthier, wealthier, more secure than ever before, ceases to create the human future, in the most elemental sense of creating the human future, namely creating next generations, I think we have to say that something like a spiritual crisis is at hand. And in those circumstances, the processes of assimilation and secularization that we've observed with other populations may, I submit, work in a slightly different way. This, of course, all remains to be seen, but the trend lines are not altogether reassuring. Now, in The Cube in the Cathedral, I outline four possible European futures. The first, paradise works. The EU somehow finds the money to pay for itself, does not choke to death on its own bureaucracy, and the rest of the world leaves Europe alone to its Kantian utopian pleasures. The second possibility I called Europe reconverted and thus ultimately reinvigorated. The third I called 1683 reversed, which was my tag for what others have called Eurabia. And the fourth I called the muddle, which is that some European states continue in historic and cultural continuity with their roots and others don't. Now, I wrote at the time, that human nature being what it is, a betting man would always wager on the muddle. And I still think that's true. Some are going to make it and some are not. It's very difficult for me, for example, perhaps Philip has some fresh numbers on this, I'd be very interested, to imagine a future for the Netherlands and Belgium that is not dramatically different 30, 40, 50 years from now than it is today. Now, as the inimitable Mark Stein wrote some time ago, in a battle between Pornostan and the Islamic Republic of the Netherlands, it's not clear which side you should be on, but those may be the options here. Now, I do think the muddle is likely to be true because that's the normal state of human affairs. But the clock is running, the demographics are disturbing, and the creative minorities that could give Europe a new birth of freedom, rightly understood, and help in the assimilation project, rightly understood, seem to me not to be getting as much traction as one would like. Now, there is some hope politically. If the center-right were to return to power in Italy, especially in Spain, in the elections later this month, and in the United Kingdom, if Sarkozy follows through in France, all of which events might strengthen the Merkel forces in Germany and give the new Polish government the political room to do what it knows it should do, both at home and in Europe, as the representative of one of the last intact Christian cultures in Europe, then we might see an interesting period in which the kind of governmental obstacles to assimilation that Philip described so well could be dismantled, and a serious process of assimilation and indeed of wrestling with the many legal, cultural, social, economic facets of new immigrant populations could take place. That we must hope for, and at least batting 500 on that list of four electoral prospects is not at all outside the realm of possibility in the next several months. However, let me come back at the end to the beginning, and that is to note that public policy, however important, can only change so much. And unless European culture, unless the spiritual life of Europe, if you will, pulls out of the crash dive of metaphysical boredom, its problems in assimilating immigrants from a very different cultural orbit will only intensify. My normal métier is not Jeremiah. I'm much more an Isaiah guy. But it is very difficult when one spends time in Europe, as both Philip and I do on a regular basis, to come away with the sense of a robust culture, a spiritually vigorous culture that is capable of facing these kinds of new challenges. Rather, what I found in Spain, for example, last November, was a government prepared to fight the battles of the 1930s all over again, to rewrite history and rewrite human nature by the force of law. And I found a population generally quite acquiescent to that because they were all doing quite well economically. Meanwhile, all of the old communists, or many of the old communists in Andalusia, are becoming Muslims. Once a monist, always a monist, I suppose. It's not a pretty picture, and it's one that I think we have to take seriously, not only because we are inextricably connected to Europe historically and culturally, but because the kinds of multiculturalist shibboleths that I've described and that Philip described the practical consequences of are alive and well in our own high culture, in our own political culture. And should things go one way rather than the other way in November, we too will be having these arguments full blast in the United States in the first part of the 21st century. Thank you.
Okay, make sure that these mics work. Okay. Yep. Well, as I said, we'd like to give Phil and George a chance to respond to each other. And Phil, would you like to?
Boy, a number of things. I suppose what we're discussing here is what we might call the Oscar hypothesis, which is Europe is no country for young men, and secondly, there will be blood. And I have a number of issues with what George says. Clearly, when he talks about the cultural crisis, spiritual crisis, and so on, clearly I strongly agree with him. But here are a couple of thoughts. 40% of the people of Rotterdam are Muslims. Well, let's look at that.
Teenagers.
Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I do apologize. You're dead right.
Rotterdam and Amsterdam.
Fine. 40% of Rotterdam teenagers are Muslims. What do we mean by that? Do we mean people of a faith commitment? Do we mean people who observe Muslim Muslim requirements, who keep Ramadan? The short answer is, I don't know, and I don't believe you know, because I don't think we have those figures. What we do know is 40% are of Muslim background. What that actually means in practice, there are many there are many possibilities. The likelihood is, certainly the way the trends are going at the moment, that they are also going to decide in a few years that, gee, they're just having so much fun to bother to have children. What happens when Europe can no longer bring in Muslim immigrants because they're running out of Algerians? They've run out of Tunisians. They're running out of Moroccans. To maintain that welfare state, well, they have to do what they've been doing for the last few years, which is they dig deeper and deeper into Africa, where they come up with Christians. Now, if you go to some of those no-go areas, it's very interesting. Saint-Denis, Aulnay-sous-Bois, all the area of the 93 department around Paris, they're no-go areas for white people. There's a real lot of Christians in those areas. There's a real lot of Nigerian churches and Thai churches and Chinese churches. And of course, don't forget, up until about 10 years ago, the second largest immigrant group in France, the Portuguese. Okay? I tend to see this more in, I think, racial terms than religious. I would also add one thing before I throw this over to George, which is how much the presence of Islam and the presence of a very militant kind of Islam, as suggested by the cartoon controversy, has itself brought Christians out of the closet, so to speak. And some of the statements that have come from really surprisingly liberal church leaders in the last few years have been amazing. For example, there's an Anglican bishop in England. We mentioned the unfortunate Rowan. Let me confess confess something here. He is from the next town over from me. I claim no
connection. Another Welshman. There we go.
I claim no connection, and I'd much rather focus on the other famous person from that same town as him, who is Catherine Zeta-Jones. A much greater spiritual leader with better legs.
Better hair, too.
We could go on at this for some length. But the point is, if you look at some of the other statements from other bishops, you have Bishop Nazir Ali, an interesting name for an Anglican bishop of a Pakistani Shiite family. And if you look at his statements, almost everything you touch in British culture, whether it's art, literature, or the language itself, has been shaped by the Judeo-Christian tradition, by the Bible, by the church's worship and belief. Where are we? It could certainly be argued that there is an agenda behind a claim that a 5% adherence to other faiths makes for a multi-faith society. I don't believe that could have been said better by people at this very table. It has been so interesting in Britain, for example, to see the return of St. George in the last 20 years, and particularly in the last 5 years. In the 1980s, the cross of St. George was absolutely unknown as a symbol. It's very hard to believe if you go to Britain now, and it's everywhere. St. George is back. And across Europe, I've been startled how many people have said in so many words following the cartoon crisis, soon the next thing will be they won't let you go to church. Not, of course, that these are people who'd ever gone to church in the first place, but some of them have actually considered it. And then you have people who are rather mainstream people, traditionally would have been very secular, who have re-explored the Christian roots. And I quote one of my favorites is from Jürgen Habermas, who decided a few years ago to channel his inner John Paul II when he said that Christianity and nothing less and nothing else is the ultimate foundation of liberty, conscience, human rights, and democracy, the benchmarks of Western civilization. To this day, we have no other options, parenthesis, to Christianity. We continue to nourish ourselves from this source. Everything else is postmodern chatter. That's Habermas. Typical? Of course not, but I can point to a remarkable number of cultural Christians, and I think the presence of Islam and the presence of that assault on Western traditions of civilization from some Muslims has had a potent effect in making people rethink what those are. So when you look 30 or 40 years down the road, how different will those politics be? Well, of course, it's quite possible. We'll have a Europe which is maybe 10 or 15% Muslim by background, if not by practice, say 15%, just to take a high number. But maybe we will have more people who are Christian, not just by family background. And I'm just going to throw in a final word to complexify once more, which is if there is a country that seriously does have to worry about Islamization, it's one neither of us have mentioned, which is Russia. That is a country in which the Diffie Musulman is very serious. It's probably 15% Muslim right now, and it has far worse demographics. So I will throw that over.
All very good stuff. Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Keith. Let me begin with Michael Nazir Ali, who's a friend of mine and a man with whom I'm in fairly frequent correspondence. Michael and his family are now living under police protection because of his criticism of certain facets of aggressive Islam in the UK. And of course, he